Welcome to the What Doesn't Kill You and What Just Might podcast.
Welcome to Cheat Sheet, a bite-sized companion podcast to WDKY, where we reveal actionable tips and best practices that can help your company cheat death. My guest today is Jeremy Tan, my friend and co-founder at Tinman Capital. Jeremy is a corporate finance expert and has been both a sell-side banker and a buy-side investor at some of the world's largest financial institutions. He has worked on multi-billion dollar investment, IPO, and M&A transactions, as well as raise capital for high-growth startups. Welcome, Jeremy.
Hi, Muli. Thanks for having me over.
So, Jeremy, we know this. Investors evaluate startups all the time. How should founders evaluate prospective investors?
That's something that I think about and advise some of our portfolio companies who have actually going through a raise themselves after our round. I think at the end of the day, we've got to be clear about the objective. I think the objective is to find investors that's a fit for you. And that could be many ways, right? It could be business fit, horizon in terms of, you know, when you want to build a business, when you want to exit, and so on and so forth, right? Now, I'll break it down to a few things. I think first and foremost is, do they understand your industry? Yeah, I think that's quite an important basis to that, because if they understand your industry, chances are they'll buy behind your vision. I think the other aspect is, what type of investors are they? Are they what we call financial investors, i.e. they tend not to get involved in the companies? Or are they strategic, where I also include VCs who get more hands-on as well? So you got to be clear what you want and choose accordingly. And I think there's some questions you can ask about active investors to test, you know, really what do they bring to the table, and ask them specifically what value they bring, and does that gel with your expectation?
I think it's important, as you rightly said, to figure out, as an entrepreneur, what do you want out of the investor? Some entrepreneurs that I know are extremely clear about exactly how they want to run their business, and they don't want involvement from their investors.
Mm-hmm.
So for those folks, I think getting involved with, or getting into bed, let's say, with a very active-minded investor probably isn't a good fit. I'm sure you agree with that.
So yeah.
In those situations, I imagine you actually might actually want a group of investors, all of whom are happy for you to take the lead as the entrepreneur. Whereas some other entrepreneur might say, no, look, I'm very clear. Here are my strengths, but I want someone who can complement me and bring other things to me.
Mm.
So that's, at least in my mind, the way that I would, you know, advise an entrepreneur. First, figure out the basics of what you're looking for.
Mm.
And one thing I do want to say is, before we even get to the point of what question and topics to explore with your prospective investors, that yes, you are the one being evaluated, sure. But you can evaluate your prospective investors, you know, respectfully and even with humor sometimes, right?
That's right.
And I would say the best investors, whether they are the pure financial or the operational types, will take your evaluation as a signal that you take them seriously. You're not just out to maximize valuation, right? You're trying to gauge the relationship. On the other hand, I would say if an investor takes offense at being quote-unquote evaluated, that tells you a lot about how they will act after they've invested, right? So beware is what I would say.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I think it's a good point you bring up, Muli. And I've said that at some of the conferences I've spoken on. And it's two ways. You know, there's a bit of a mindset that the companies need to pander to the investors, but, you know, we disagree. It needs to be both ways for that marriage to work out. And I think, yes, absolutely right, Nick, to your point about what do you want? I think once you're clear what you want, go about finding it, and there are ways to find out, right?
Mm.
I think there are other elements as well, which includes the fund mechanics. What's their fund life? Because that's an important measure, because if their fund life expires in, I don't know, 3 years, 5 years, that means that they need to have a plan to exit all their positions and return to their investors, their LPs. And that will inform you in terms of the amount of runway that you have with them before they ask to plan for an exit event, right? And as an entrepreneur, that's important to know, because that has to match up, right? I mean, you have a dream, you have your vision. It takes a while to execute. You may not know that. But at the point when you're evaluating them, you need to have an understanding, how much runway do I have? And don't go in blind, right?
Right. So in fact, maybe we should unpack that statement even a little bit for some of our entrepreneurs who may not be as familiar with VC fund sort of inside baseball, as they call it, right?
Yeah, let's unpack that a bit, right? I think it's a good point. Generally, funds are set up with a finite fund life, to which there at the end of it, you need to exit the positions and return the money to their investors, their LPs. Generally, the point is that they need to have a plan to exit. So that's one. And that informs one aspect of it. There's an aspect about investment period where it's a period to which the fund can make new investments, i.e. beyond that period, they're not allowed to make any more new checks to new companies.
Mm.
They can do follow-on, but that tells you, you know, the number of new companies they can write to.
Mm.
That informs less in terms of when an entrepreneur trying to figure out how much runway they have with the investor.
Mm.
But nevertheless, I think something important for them to know. And follow-on, you need to understand whether that fund itself, do they have a track record of following on? And it's an important aspect because it sends a very strong signal when you're raising future rounds, especially if when your existing investors do not follow on, right? It's human nature that the other investors looking at that would be in a new round, be like, why is that? Is there something that I don't know about? So I guess the advice is to pick funds that will follow on. And it's also from a fundraising standpoint, is the economies of scale, right? People that are really convinced before, been with you for a number of years, they're convinced and they will make up for part of the round.
Right? Yeah.
Specifically, the question we will ask them is to understand, like, how much dry powder do you set aside?
Mm.
Is it 20%, 30%, 40% of the fund to do follow-ons? And that's an important number to know. And though it's not a guarantee, because at the end of the day, it's their discretion whether to follow on with you, but it gives an indication, right? So I think that probably unpacks the element of that, right?
And just to give people, I think, some benchmarks as to what follow-on typically might be, I would say the average venture stage fund, I'm not talking about seed stage, let's say accelerators and so on, but the venture stage, would set aside for every dollar they invest in a new check, probably 50 cents to another dollar for all subsequent follow-on rounds. There are firms who are exceptions to this. Some will say, look, very clear messaging, we don't follow on. And that's good because they've been very clear. It actually helps you, the entrepreneur, to explain this in the future if someone else asks you, why isn't your prior investor following on? Certain other funds will have the opposite. They'll say, look, I come in super early, but actually my size of the fund is very large. So therefore, I'm really reserving most of my capital for follow-ons.
Yeah, I think I just want to add a nuance to that, right? Because numbers get thrown around, right? And some people will say, oh, I set aside 20, 30% of the fund. The number that you picked up was like, look, for each dollar invest, I set aside 50 cents to a dollar more for follow-on.
Mm.
That's only for companies that they want to follow on.
Right.
So they don't follow on all companies. So as a result, on average, it works out to, you know, a percentage of the fund that, you know, is lesser than, obviously, probably maybe in the range of 20, 30%. I think the point here is that when entrepreneurs get the numbers from the investor, just be aware of the different definition that goes behind those numbers.
Good point.
I think also there are a few other things that they should be aware of before we go to the questions and the hows. It also includes aspects like their process, right? We talked about how is it like to be with that investor on the journey with them. But prior to the journey itself, there's a part called the dating period where you're trying to secure a term sheet from them, right? And really understanding their process to me is very important. Do they front load their due diligence or do they backload that, right? That's one question.
Mm.
And what do I mean by that? It means that do they quickly give you a term sheet signed and punt the due diligence further down the road? And that's implication because that means that that term sheet they receive from that fund is not as certain as you think because it's still subjected to due diligence and so on. And some term sheets don't make it very clear. I would advise founders to ask that explicitly. Because be aware, once you sign the term sheet, there'll be a no show up. Practically, even with 45 days, the other investors that are interested in you will move on. Right? Do they need to lead? And once they give you a term sheet, how often have they walked away from a term sheet and why? It's okay for investors to walk away from a term sheet for valid reasons, that they find out something that was grossly misrepresented to them, right? But nevertheless, something you need to know. And the time frame, their process is very important to managing timelines. Because at the end of the day, you want as many of the term sheets as possible to be offered to you and come in at the same time. There's no point for the term sheets to come in at 2 months apart. It doesn't allow you the opportunity to evaluate and then to negotiate for a better position for yourself.
Right. Yeah.
So that's another aspect, I think, of evaluation of investors that I like to share with founders.
We've talked a fair bit, actually, about traditional venture fund construct here. I do also want to mention that when we say evaluating prospective investors, it doesn't only have to mean venture fund investors. It can mean individuals, can mean angel clubs. It can even mean, let's say, corporate investors, right? So I would say you can ask your investors straight out, what is your vision for my company? And this is especially important, I would say, for corporate investors, because there's no right answer to this question, but whatever they tell you tells you a lot about how this investor thinks, what that person's aspirations are for making the investment, because they're clearly an employee. By when do they hope to achieve an exit? Whether she prefers to let you run the show or wants to be, you know, actively involved, you know, as a potential partner of the business. So whatever the answer is, you will get some insight on how you will engage with each other in the future. Now, once you get some sort of sense of that, you can then decide, look, is there congruence here or do I actually prefer a different investor? Terms aside, but just literally, you know, do I engage with this person in the appropriate way?
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. And thanks for pointing out that the other buckets of investors as well, right? I think for this episode, I don't think we have time to unpack like the nuance of strategic investors and so on, but that general point that you raised does apply, and I agree with that, right?
So we've talked a fair bit about the investor as a firm. I think it's also important to realize that you're actually talking about individuals as well. And I would encourage founders to remember, look, almost everyone puts up some public-facing information about themselves online. So I would say go look at that, figure out what this person is interested in, what their personality is like, potentially even before you talk to them, right? And I'm generally doubtful about people who post nothing about themselves online. And I even find it downright yucky if I can only find heavily stage-managed puff pieces in magazines. So I'm clearly very interested in how the individual thinks and, you know, what their motivations are and so on. The reason for asking this is, if I were a founder in their shoes, I would want to know, do I enjoy engaging with this investor? Does this person provide supportive feedback but also challenges me? Do they complement the skills I already have available within my company and board of directors? Things like that. And of course, the traditional airport test, right? If I was stuck in an airport overnight with them having missed our last flight, would this be a painful experience or would it still be okay?
Yeah, the airport test is quite important.
Maybe after COVID goes away.
I think, you know, we can replace the airport test with maybe something more appropriate called the Zoom test, right? I mean, spending time, long hours on a call with someone in times like this. But generally, I think the point is, do you enjoy engaging the person? Or if they ask for a call, you're like, oh my God, you know, why do I have to do this now? And so on. I think building a company is hard enough. You certainly want to do that with people you enjoy, truly enjoy. At the end of the day, when you get a term sheet, there are many terms that you want to evaluate. I think it ties back to the point that you brought earlier about, do they share the vision? Because at the end of the day, it's the person and not really the firm. Except that in the cases where you're dealing with a partner who founded the firm, for example, then they are the firm. Don't get caught up on headline numbers like valuation. At some point, the numbers, whilst different, one may be higher and lower. It's like getting a degree. Once you get a degree, it's a passport for you to get a job. But once you land that job, it starts from a clean slate, right? And for me, valuation is similar.
I'm glad you say this, by the way, because you have the first class honors, I don't.
So whilst I believe that it's important to look at all the points and evaluate them, however, don't lose the overall picture here. Mm. At the end of the day, I would suggest trading off maybe a slightly lower valuation for people that you know you can work with and who's aligned with your vision and fundamentally supportive people. Because at the end of the day, entrepreneurship by definition is uncertain, right? Anyone who says that, yeah, I know what's going to happen in the next 6 months, it's just outright lying. And you need people who understand that it's uncertain and be willing to be with the journey with you.
Yeah.
And to understand what has transpired, not let you get you down just because you missed a quarter of earnings and so on. And to say, okay, what can we do here? And what can we do given the information we know, right? I think it's far more important than some percentage points in terms of valuation.
In fact, you're making an important point about soft factors that you should evaluate when you're looking to your investors. But actually, this also matters in a hard context, hard factors, in the sense that if your investors paying the highest possible price, they also have no room for any errors in the future. So they're going to treat it very, very, you know, clearly saying, look, you asked me to pay the highest price, I expect you to deliver. So that's actually a sword hanging over your head as well.
It's a point that I agree with. And then some founders have come and boast about, you know, the valuation, how much dilution they have minimized. I recall this conversation. Another founder said to another founder about how successful his round was and oversubscribed and, you know, what great valuation we got. The other founder was like, look, very happy for you. But at the end of the day, you know there'll be a big sword hanging over your head, right? You know, it's a double-edged sword, right? It is about hard factors as well, but also there's so nuance behind that at this point. Increasingly, you're seeing other funds, especially larger funds from overseas, you know, US and Europe, taking interest in this region. And the way they look at it is more from, I'm going to put in a few million here, depending on your fund size. And those few million, it really is a very small part of your funds. But to them, it's an optionality bet. They're very insensitive evaluation because this is a small part of their fund. They just want to get into look-in. I guess the founders, they just be aware of that. Well, yes, it's nice to have someone validate you through a nice bump in valuation. Then it also informs you of how they view you as overall part of your strategy, right?
One other aspect that I sometimes focus on, and even when I've been on a board as an independent, I'll ask the founder to figure out, who is doing the work of evaluating my company? Has it been delegated to a junior employee or possibly even to an external consultant? Or the person who's actually going to be on my board after the fundraising, is that the person doing it? And this is an important aspect. There's no wrong way, right? In fact, if you have an external consultant or a junior employee doing it, it might well be that their model is simply, look, we have a portfolio of 50 companies and we'll write checks for each of them, but we are meant to be really hands-off. All we really want is the quarterly report to come in. And if that's what you're looking for, I think it's perfectly fine. But if, on the other hand, if the person engaging with you says, look, I'm going to be on the board of a company, I'm going to be involved in a lot of detail, you know, 5 years from now, but they're not actually involved in the actual evaluation of your company, there's a bit of a mismatch.
Yeah, of course, because, you know, you can't really be hands-on when you don't know anything about the company, right? Or even have the interest to actually bother do the, at least the, maybe not deep dive, but, you know, high-level study of the company and understanding what drivers they of these companies.
Mm. How would you say founders should do reference checks on investors?
I think certainly that social media point that you brought up earlier, for sure, there's so much information out there.
Mm.
Not just about what they put out in terms of philosophy and, you know, the investing philosophy and so on, but also like, look, how are they as outside work? I think it tells you a lot about the person. Speak to other VC firms as well. Usually they are more in the know, and because they have come across them or they have spoken to other portfolio companies. And I think finally also, just speaking to the portfolio companies, founders that this fund you're evaluating have backed, right? Mm. Ask for introduction, but do your own co-evaluation as well, i.e. try to reach out to some of the founders without going through the VC that you're evaluating.
So without informing them, a blind check.
A blind check, correct. Mm. I think those are some of the classic way of doing that. But I'm a bit more traditional in some ways. I think nothing beats just spending time.
Mm.
From my perspective, I try to get time with them when I evaluate founders. Yeah, I encourage founders to do that as well. I think through the informal gathering, you get asked about anything. People are more relaxed and you get to see them in action outside of work. And catching them at different timings, different people behave differently at
In different contexts.
In different contexts. But also, some days they have bad days for them. Some days, you know, they have good days.
Right.
So, whilst you want to manage the amount of time you spend with people, I think it's worthwhile investment to try to break it up into different days, different settings, where you get different data and for you to be able to assess more accurately how they are as a person and as a firm, right?
Yeah. In fact, I would even go as so far as to say that I would overweight this side of it. Yes, you should do the reference checks, but your sample size is likely to be small. So I wouldn't put too much trust by that. I would rather say, look, trust your own gut instinct when you deal with the person directly yourself.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Gut feeling, it's key, right? I mean, I've trusted my gut over the years and I think people should listen to their gut, right? And not suppress it.
Yeah. One other point that I did want to make sure that entrepreneurs are aware of is going back to the firm level. You should understand, does this firm have an eat-what-you-kill philosophy with individual investment partners responsible for their own successful or failed investments? Or are you likely to be working with more than one investment partner, and so therefore they are equally incentivized to make your company successful? And I would say both approaches are valid, both exist, right? It's just a question of what you would like to prioritize as a founder. If you want, actually literally, I want Jeremy to be on my board and I really don't care that he works for Tin Man and whoever his partners, you know, I really don't care because I really like Jeremy. That's one valid way to do it. If rather you're saying, look, I'm looking for a more strategically involved investor or potentially a passive investor, then you actually want to know that you are dating the right firm rather than necessarily an individual.
Yeah, I think they are very different models, both valid, as you said. We do it differently in the sense that we are more the second model whereby there's one book, we all share the benefit for one book. And there's a philosophy we share. But coming back from the founder's standpoint, just be aware there are two different models, right? And the different interests that drives them. And you make a decision taking that into account as well. But we need to be aware of the pros and cons. If the economy is one that eat what you kill, then clearly the other partners in the firm may have time for you, probably compared to a model whereby it's one book, they're less incentivized. I'm just making a very general statement here, right?
Yeah.
But on the flip side, when you have a one book policy, there could be a danger where there's no one partner who is...
Your chief advocate.
Yeah, your chief advocate, right? And certainly, I think speaking from Team Man's standpoint, we are very aware of that. And what we try to do is that obviously for each portfolio company, there's a chaperone, right?
Yeah.
And I think from a founder standpoint, as you evaluate both models, be aware of the pros and cons. And it's possible to, in this case, for example, say, hey, look, who's my chaperone? And if you're convinced that the chaperone is one person that you want to deal with, but then yet you get the benefit and tap into all the other partners, network, yeah, that's best of both worlds, right? And similarly, I think you need to be aware of what the other model brings to the table and make a trade-off based on that. Yeah.
So the point you made just now, I think, was quite useful. In fact, I would go one step further and say, it's also important for you to understand, is this person you're speaking to an employee of her firm or a partner with some influence and stake in her firm's success? And I make this point because it's actually less about the person's title than the responsibility given to her and a willingness and ability to resume these responsibilities. We're actually, as you're well aware, one of our portfolio companies is raising an extra round of capital, right? And one of the parties looking at it, the person is not a partner. They're relatively junior in the overall hierarchy, but they're highly motivated. I've seen this firsthand. And I know that he is going to make sure that the partnership is behind this investment if they make the investment. So that's your point about the chaperone. So even though they're not a partner, I think they'll be a great advocate when they come in.
Yeah. Just one more point to add about the chaperone. I think coming back to the soft point, but I think it's an important point as well. When evaluating investors, or actually it's the same way I evaluate startup founders, I think people underrate honesty.
How do you mean?
If I'm a founder, I want people to tell me what I'm doing right and what I'm doing wrong. Don't sugarcoat. Just tell me. You don't have to be rude.
Mm.
Just be upfront and don't have to hide, right? And I look at it in the founders because I want to know what's happening, you know, all the good and the bad, because only when you get to the truth, then we collectively have a chance of attacking it. And similarly, I think founders, I will encourage them to look for the same traits among investors. So you have this honor system going. Even conversation like, look, I'm raising another round. Are you going to follow on? I'd rather find out now they're not going to follow on than for you to be delayed. Because in reality, there may be a position where the fund may have run out of capital. Not because anyone's fault. It's just that they deployed and you just happen to be last on the list. And I'd rather know that, for example, and have that conversation early so that I can plan my next course of action. And through this experience of having tough conversation openly, I think that's when you build trust that it's lasting for the long run and for great partnerships to work out, right?
I think that's a great place to stop. I'll just quickly summarize what we've learned. Make sure that you're aware what your priorities are and make sure that the investors you're speaking to have those same priorities, number one. Number two, evaluate the individual as well as the firm and figure out whether they're a good fit for you. And number three, eventually you want to lead to, as you just said, a relationship based on honesty and candor. Thank you.
Thank you.
The WDKY podcast is brought to you by Tin Man Capital. You'll find a transcript based on this episode on our blog at tinman.asia/blog. This episode was produced by Multistory and written and hosted by Murli Ravi. If you liked this episode, tell your friends about WDKY. And if you didn't like it, well, tell your enemies. Send questions, comments, and beer suggestions to wdky@tinman.asia. Tune in again next time for another episode of What Doesn't Kill You and What Just Might.